Once you've written out all the various solutions to your problem, you're now ready to move to step six, the decision-making phase. This is perhaps one of the most crucial skills of all of success in America. The ability to make decisions is one of the most important requirements for advancement at any job in any organization. Interestingly enough, it's not necessarily the quality of the decisions that count, but the willingness to reach conclusions and make those decisions in the first place. In one study, two groups of managers were tested for their decision-making ability. One of the groups was on the fast track. They were enjoying rapid promotion and regular increases in pay. They were seen to be very decisive and were always willing to accept responsibility for results. The second group was made up of managers who had been passed over for promotion because they seemed to be unable to make decisions in their areas of responsibility. They tested both groups of managers in a classroom setting for the accuracy of their decision-making. They gave them a series of simulated problem situations and tested them on what decisions they would make. Interestingly enough, both the effective and ineffective managers turned out to be equally accurate in their answers to the questions on this classroom test. In other words, their decision-making abilities were the same. The difference between the groups was simply that at work, the effective managers were willing to take the risk of making the decisions, whereas the ineffective managers, equally accurate in their choices, avoided decision-making for fear of making a mistake. Now, here are some important ideas that will help you to make more right decisions in your life and in your career. The first questions that you have to ask in decision-making are these three. First, what are you trying to achieve with the decision? Second, what are you trying to avoid? Third, what are you trying to preserve? Every decision is aimed at achieving, avoiding, or preserving something. These are called decision criteria or boundary conditions. The very best decision makers are those who clearly identify these criteria and make them measurable before they move to the final decision-making phase. Another question is, what must you accomplish with this decision? What is the very minimum that this decision must achieve? How would you measure the success of this decision? If you were to come back to it later and look at the results of the decision, if the decision had been perfect, what would have happened? For example, if you're going to make a decision to spend a certain amount of money, you would have to ask, what am I trying to achieve, avoid, or preserve? If the money were to be spent on advertising, you would write down exactly what kind of measurable results you would achieve if the advertising money was well spent. If you're thinking of accepting a new job, getting into a serious relationship, or starting your own business, it's very important for you to sit down and write out what you would expect to gain as a result of making this decision correctly. These decision criteria or boundary conditions then become the template against which you measure the suitability of each of the solutions that you've developed in the previous phase of problem solving. Before we continue with this, however, here are some blocking assumptions that often get in the way of effective decision making. A blocking assumption is an assumption that may or may not be true. The first blocking assumption is, does this decision have to be made at all? In other words, is it possible to avoid making this decision? Often, delaying a decision makes the decision unnecessary. A very wise idea is to put off decision-making whenever you possibly can if it's not necessary to decide at this time. Another blocking assumption is that the decision has to be made by you. Is it possible that someone else could make this decision? Would it be better for someone else to make this decision? For example, in my business, as the president of my company, I'm often approached by different people offering different products, services, and ideas. Some years ago, I felt that it was my prerogative to make any decision that came across my desk. Over time, however, I found that if I had hired people with expertise in these areas, these decisions no longer had to be made by me. Now, unless it's a decision that only I can make, I always refer the responsibility for the decision to someone else. This greatly simplifies my life, just as it would simplify your life if you tried it. Whenever you can delegate decision-making to someone else, you should do it. Another question you need to ask, another blocking assumption is, can you afford to make this decision? can you afford the negative consequences of making this decision incorrectly? If you cannot afford the negative consequences of a bad decision or a decision that doesn't work out, then you should avoid making the decision altogether. If the possible negative ramifications of the decision are such that it could dramatically harm your company, your career, your financial status, or your family, you should put the decision off. On the other hand, there are some decisions that you cannot afford not to make. There are some decisions, sometimes in the form of opportunities, that when they come along, you cannot afford to sit on the fence about them. You have to step up to the plate and make a decision one way or the other. So ask yourself, is this a decision that we cannot afford not to make? Often in business, you may have to make a decision concerning ethics or government regulations. This is the kind of decision that you cannot afford to leave hanging. You have to step up, accept responsibility, and pass judgment. And finally, can this decision be delayed or deferred? One of the very best recommendations for decision-making of any kind is to sleep on it. Many decisions that seem obvious late in the afternoon seem totally different by the light of dawn the next day. Whenever you can buy time on an important decision, even an entire weekend, be sure to do it. Remember, it's not necessary to decide immediately. The more time that you can take to reflect on a decision, the more likely it is that you're going to make the correct decision when you finally do decide. One of the best time savers and money makers in your entire life is to make the right decision in the first place so that you don't have to spend the time and effort in going back to correct the wrong decision later. Write out a list of your boundary conditions and the things that this decision must accomplish if it's to be a correct and effective decision. Then, compare the solutions that you developed earlier against these boundary conditions and requirements. Which of these solutions seems most ideal when compared against the objective decision-making criteria that you've developed? This method takes a little bit longer and requires a good deal of discipline, but it avoids the tendency that most people have to rush to a judgment, to jump to conclusions with too little information or evidence. Whenever you force yourself to slow down the decision-making process, you increase your ability to remain unemotional and objective. This then increases the quality of your decision-making when you reach the end of the process. Once you've chosen the best decision, the decision that best satisfies all the conditions that you've identified, then you go on to choose the second best decision. Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor who created modern Germany in the latter part of the 19th century, was famous for always having a plan B in every situation. No matter what reverses he suffered diplomatically, he always had a fully developed alternative to fall back on. You should develop this as a lifelong policy. Remember, you are only as free as your options or your well-developed alternatives. The decision-making process is a good opportunity for you to think through what you will do if the first choice of a solution doesn't accomplish the goals that you intended. Before you make a final decision, you should assess the possible adverse consequences of the decision. You should, in effect, fill out a catastrophe report. A catastrophe report answers the question, what is the worst possible thing that could happen as a result of this decision? What is the maximum possible cost of this decision? What are the minimum possible results of this decision? And am I willing to live with those possible consequences should they occur? Many people start businesses, make investments, or embark on various courses of action without ever thinking through the very worst that could happen as a result. Your ability to carefully consider the secondary consequences of your actions is a vital part of skilled thinking. It'll make you more creative by making you more alert and aware. You will make fewer mistakes, leading to fewer losses, and you'll be correct more often. If you're not willing to live with the worst possible consequences of your decision, then don't make the decision. In the business schools, they call this mini-max decision-making. Minimax decision making means that you minimize the maximum worst possible outcome of the situation. You think through what the very least negative consequence might be if you make a decision. For example, if you're planning to spend a large amount of money on a marketing campaign to sell a product or service and generate a certain amount of revenue, what is the worst possible thing that could happen? Well, the worst possible thing that could happen is that the marketing campaign will be a total failure and that you will sell absolutely nothing. All of your advertising and promotion money could be lost. If this were to happen, what would be the effect on your company, your cash flow, or your career? Don't make the mistake called the fallacy of large numbers. I've embarked on advertising and promotional campaigns in the past based on the idea that if only a tiny percentage of people who are exposed to the advertising buy, then it will be a profitable and effective advertising campaign. This fallacy of large numbers often leads to expenditures of money that end up being completely wasted. Not only do the minimum number of people not respond to the advertising, but often no one responds to the advertising at all. The entrepreneurial ranks of America are littered with the corpses of small businesses that fell prey to this fallacy of large numbers. The business owner failed to analyze the worst possible consequences of the investment, and as a result, found himself or herself out of cash and out of business in short order. Now, there are three other methods of decision-making that can be useful under various circumstances. The first is what is called the balance sheet method. You simply take a pad of paper, draw a line down the center from top to bottom, and write out all the pros and cons on opposite sides of the page. You can put a plus sign at the top of one side of the page and a minus sign at the top of the other. Write out every reason that you can think of for going ahead under the plus sign, and every reason that you can think of for not going ahead under the minus sign. Once you've written out these answers, examine them carefully and see if that doesn't resolve the question. In sales, this is often called the Ben Franklin close, and it's a very useful way of making decisions because it imitates on paper the way our brain works when we're trying to make any kind of decision. A second idea for decision making, when there seems to be very little difference between decisions, is to pick the very best one based on your best judgment and plunge ahead. Then, be willing to accept feedback and self-correct. Be willing to learn from the results of the decision and change your course if necessary. If the decision has to be made but it's questionable, monitor the implementation of the decision closely until you get a good feel for whether or not it was the right decision in the first place. The third method of decision making is called the point scoring system. In this system, you divide 1,000 imaginary points among the decision criteria that you've identified and written down earlier. You assign each of these criteria points based on its relative value or importance in the decision. For example, if you're going to hire a sales manager, you might say that one of the decision criteria is successful experience selling your product or service with another company and managing a team of people who also sold successfully. Out of 1,000 points, you might give this single criteria 500 or 600 points. You might also want this sales manager to live reasonably close to your place of business. However, you might only give this decision criteria 50 points because it wouldn't be critically important to the successful performance of the job. Once you've allocated the points to the decision criteria, then you compare the decision criteria with a solution that you've developed and see which of those solutions most adequately solves the problem based on these points. Which solution gets the most points when you add them up? Once you've thought through and finally made your decision, the seventh step is to assign specific responsibility to a person or persons to implement the decision and do the job. When you assign this responsibility, set a clear deadline for completion and for review, even for yourself. It's amazing how many otherwise excellent decisions come to nothing because the decision maker did not follow through with a firm delegation of responsibility tied to a clear deadline. Remember, a decision without a deadline is just a meaningless discussion that usually ends up with you wrestling with the problem and making the decision over and over again. Once you've assigned or accepted clear responsibility and set a deadline for action and completion, then either hold your own feet to the fire or hold the other person's feet to the fire. Inspect what you expect. Never assume that it will be done properly and done on time unless you keep on top of it. If it's a decision for yourself, use a forcing system. Promise someone else that it will be done by a specific deadline. Set up a reward structure to encourage and motivate yourself to fulfill your commitment. It's terribly important to your success in every area of your life that you make firm decisions and that you follow through on those decisions and complete your transactions. This is one of the most important qualities and characteristics of successful men and women in every walk of life in America, and it's absolutely essential for you to develop in yourself. Finally, in this systematic process of problem solving and decision making, step number 8 is for you to follow up, monitor the decision, and compare actual results with expected results. For example, if you spend a certain amount of time or money, you should clearly identify the measurable results that you expect from the successful implementation of this solution or decision. You should then measure afterwards to see if you achieved those results. You should evaluate and assess the correctness of the decision and be willing to alter or revise the decision as you get further feedback. You can then use this information to generate new and better solutions and new and better courses of action. To summarize this powerful, systematic method of creative problem solving and decision making, here are the 8 steps that can make you think and act like a genius. 1. Approach the situation confidently and positively, with an expectant attitude that you are fully capable of finding a workable solution to any problem that you face. 2. Use positive language. Use the word situation or challenge or opportunity to describe the difficulty that you're facing. 3. Define the situation or challenge clearly in writing. Write it out on paper so that everyone who's involved in solving the difficulty agrees with the definition. Then ask, what else is the situation? And develop alternative ways of describing the difficulty. 4. Identify all the possible causes. Take some time to think through why this situation occurred in the first place so that you can be sure to deal with core causes rather than with symptoms. 5. Identify all the possible solutions. Write down every single solution that you can think of before you begin moving toward a decision. This is the really creative phase of the process. Ask, what else could be a solution? 6. Make a decision. Write out the decision criteria and compare each of your developed solutions to the decision criteria to be sure that the decision that you pick is the best one under the circumstances. Your ability to do this will have more of an impact on your success or failure than probably anything else that you ever do. 7. Assign specific responsibility for the implementation of the agreed-upon solution and set a deadline. Then, hold that person, even if it's yourself, to that deadline. Inspect what you expect. 8. Initiate action. Get going. Do something. Follow up and monitor progress on the decision and be ready to accept feedback from the decision and make corrections. Keep doing this until you achieve the result or solution you desire. Remember, successful people don't necessarily make the right decisions every time, but they make their decisions right. They remain flexible and open to new information. They're more concerned with what's right rather than who's right. They're willing to change course or even abandon their idea if a better solution comes along. An important skill for you to learn in the process of becoming a highly creative person is how to evaluate your new ideas objectively. First of all, remember that most ideas are not practical or worthwhile. Fully 99% of all ideas have no practical value. That's why you must put a real emphasis on continuous creativity and developing a large quantity of ideas if you're ever going to come up with any good ones. Ideas in and of themselves are a dime a dozen. They are only the start of the creative process, not the end. When you've come up with an idea and satisfied yourself that it's a good one, then the real work begins. People often come up to me in my seminars and ask me how they can protect their ideas. I even have people who write to me and offer to sell me their ideas if I will pay them cash or a royalty. This is just plain foolish. Ideas in and of themselves are of no value. They cannot be protected. It is only the ability to take action on ideas to achieve practical results that has any value. Most ideas have been thought of by others and have already been discarded. It's only when you have the conviction that leads you to turning your idea into reality that you can create any kind of value for the idea. The second key to evaluating your idea is to remain objective. Ask other knowledgeable people for their opinions of your idea and then listen with an open mind, especially to people who disagree. If people find fault with your ideas and you can't answer their questions satisfactorily, that could teach you something which could save you an enormous amount of time and money. The third key to evaluating your ideas is to let your ideas cool for a while before you launch them. Then, review them with the eye of an impartial observer. Write out your idea in full, in detail, and then put it aside for a week or even a month. When you come back to the idea, look at it objectively and see if it still looks as good as when you wrote it down. If it doesn't, be willing to adjust, adapt, or do something to your idea to make it more likely to work. In order to evaluate your idea coolly and objectively, ask, is it effective? Will it work? Will it do the job? Is it good enough to make a meaningful contribution? For many years at county fairs and traveling exhibits, there was always a booth where they sold a supposedly superior kind of spark plug that would cause your engine to run more efficiently with greater power and lower fuel consumption. The demonstration of these spark plugs was always very impressive. Many people purchased them. The problem was they were expensive and they didn't work. They were a great idea, but when put into an automobile, they had no positive impact at all. And often, they were worse than a regular spark plug that you could purchase from any filling station at a considerably lower price. The fourth key for evaluating your ideas is to ask, is it a significant improvement over the status quo? There are many ideas for products and services that are no better in terms of what they will do than what is already in the marketplace. If a product or service idea has no possibility of being a market leader, there's no real reason for investing in it and bringing it to the market at all. If it's not a significant improvement over what already exists, then it's probably not a very good idea. The fifth key to idea evaluation is to ask, is it compatible with human nature? Do people have to radically alter their behavior to use my idea? For example, there was a lot of talk over the last few years about people doing their grocery shopping by television and home computer. The idea never became popular for a simple reason, one that the promoters never thought about. It is this: shopping is both a sensuous and social experience for most people. Shoppers like to experience the great variety of colors and selection of products that they see when they go shopping. They also enjoy mixing with other shoppers. None of this is possible when shopping by computer, and so the idea has never taken off. The sixth question to ask in evaluating your ideas is it compatible with my goals? How badly do you want to try this idea? You may come up with an idea for a product or service because you've stimulated your creativity to such a high point that your mind is continually humming with new ideas. However, you must be sure that the idea is something that you can personally get excited about implementing. If you can't develop a passion or tremendous enthusiasm for an idea, it's probably not wise for you to promote it. I meet lots of people who approach me with what they consider to be great ideas, which they want someone else to do something with because they don't really care about it very much. I tell these people as politely as possible that every idea requires a champion. This is someone who passionately believes in the idea and who is willing to push ahead against all adversity to make the idea a reality. Without a champion, even the best idea will fail. The seventh consideration in evaluating your idea is the timing. Is the timing right? Is it practical now? will it be practical when it's implemented? In life, timing is everything. We marry the person who's there when we're ready to get married. We take the job that's there when we're ready to start work or to change jobs. We form lifelong friendships with people we meet unexpectedly. Often, we have children and make some of the major decisions of our life based on fortuitous timing. There is a too soon and a too late in all human affairs. Often, a product comes into the market before the market is ready for it, or just after the market has changed. Timing is crucial, and the timing of any product or service idea has to be thought through very, very carefully. A single slip with regard to timing can be enormously expensive. For example, a few years ago, Fred Smith of Federal Express tried to introduce a communications idea called Zapmail, a method of electronically transferring important documents in a matter of hours from one side of the country to the other. Federal Express spent and lost $190 million on Zapmail before it finally gave up. Just 2 years later, the first fax machines became widely available. In less than 3 years, fax machines swept the nation and everybody started using them to transfer documents quickly from one side of the country to the other. Because Fred Smith and Federal Express came into the market too early, their project was a failure and a major financial write-off. Their experience, however, wasn't unusual. It happens every single day. The eighth way of evaluating your idea is to ask, is the idea feasible? Can it be done? If it can be done, is it worth it? There are many wonderful ideas that are extraordinarily complex and expensive. The question is it possible to bring together the necessary resources in a reasonable period of time to create the product or service? And, once done, will it be possible to justify the investment by the expected return? These are hard questions to ask with regard to the research and development of any product or service idea, but they're absolutely essential questions to ask if your idea is going to work. And finally, you need to ask, is it simple? Peter Drucker, in his book, Innovation and Entrepreneurship, writes that all great innovations are simple. He says that they must be simple because there are only simple people in the world to carry them out. Complex innovations are seldom successful because there are so many opportunities for incompetent people to turn them into failures. All great innovative breakthroughs are simple, easy to understand, easy to implement, and easy to use. If you work for a corporation, there's one final part of idea generation, and that is presenting your ideas to others. First, before you approach another person with your idea, be sure that you have it clear in your own mind and that you have thought it through carefully before you discuss it with anyone else. Write out a description of the idea and analyze it using the evaluation criteria that we just discussed. Second, choose a proper time, place, and method of presentation. Consider using charts, photographs, financial analyses, or other materials that will help you to make a favorable impression. If you want to get financial support for an idea, work out the financial implications of the idea carefully on paper and have them ready to present before you discuss the idea for the first time. Third, organize and develop your presentation around the need or needs of the person whose support you require. Answer the question, what's in it for me, for the person you're talking to. Describe your idea in terms of the benefits to be expected from using the idea. In business, the major benefit the decision makers look for is an idea that will help them to gain or save time or money. Aim your presentation at these criteria and you'll always get a good hearing. Be sure to quantify the benefits in dollar terms in as much detail as possible. Fourth, in presenting your ideas, describe how you came up with it, how you evaluated the idea once you thought of it, your sources of information, and your reasoning process. This will impress the listeners that this is a serious idea. You didn't just come up with it on the way down the hall 2 minutes ago. The more information you can give on how your idea was developed, the more credible it will seem and the more seriously they will take it. Number five is, don't oversell your idea. Take the low road. There is nothing so persuasive as restrained enthusiasm. State your case moderately and accurately, and remember, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian author, said, any addition to the truth is a subtraction from it. Don't exaggerate, but just state the facts exactly as you have them on paper. Step number 6 is summarize the key points of your presentation and the key benefits of your idea at the end. Make it clear that you believe in your idea and that you would like to see it implemented. Offer to champion the idea, to accept responsibility for implementing it. Your enthusiasm can be contagious. Remember, the natural response of most people to anything new is negative. People take great delight in poking holes in new ideas. You should always expect a negative response and be prepared to bounce back with good reasons why your idea should be seriously considered. Offer to take full responsibility for testing your idea on a small scale. Ask for a small commitment of time and resources to see if the idea will really generate the benefits you're projecting. One final point. Be patient. Be willing to present your idea and just leave it for a few days. Allow the other people to take time out for mental digestion. Often, when a person has thought about an idea for 72 hours, he or she will begin to see merits in the idea that were missed when the idea was originally brought up. If you get a negative response, bide your time for a while and then go back and present your idea in a slightly different way. If you persist quietly and confidently, you'll be astonished at how often you can bring people around to your way of thinking. Intelligence is a way of acting. When you act in a systematic, organized way in problem-solving and decision-making, you actually enhance your intelligence and expand your mental capabilities. Everything that you have or ever will have, everything that you are or ever will come about as a result of the way you use your mind. If you practice what you've learned in these sessions to improve your thinking, you will improve your life, often dramatically and in a very short period of time. Now, here's an action exercise for you. Sit down and make a list of your 3 biggest problems in life right now. Select the most pressing problem, the biggest single obstacle between where you are and where you want to go. Then, sit down and work this problem or obstacle through the systematic method described earlier. Assume a logical, workable solution. Change your language and look upon it as a challenge or opportunity. Write out a clear definition of the challenge or opportunity, and then look at different definitions. Identify all possible causes of this obstacle or difficulty. Identify all the possible solutions. Develop decision criteria to enable you to pick the very best solution. Then make a decision. Decide upon a clear, measurable course of action and put a deadline on it. Finally, take action. Get going. Do something, anything, to start moving toward a resolution of your problem. Use the mindstorming or 20 idea method every morning for the next week to develop ideas to help you achieve your goals or overcome your difficulty. Discipline yourself to use these creative thinking techniques and methodologies until they become a normal and natural part of your life, like breathing in and breathing out. Within 1 month, you'll be amazed at the difference that these techniques are making in your life. You'll be amazed at how truly creative and intelligent you really are.